Chapter 7. Fear. Who do I shoot first? Now, I'm no adrenaline junkie. I don't seek out danger. I've been a college lecturer, a therapist, a communication consultant in Silicon Valley. Not a soldier, a cop, or an iron worker. So when I hear stories about real life and death situations, it gets my attention. I admire people who live with danger every day. You're about to hear some real death-defying stories, as well as some just everyday scary ones. A friend of mine from high school, Carl Johnson, spent his career in law enforcement, first in the military as an MP, and then with the Oakland Police Department. Fear and adrenaline were part of his job.
Actually, we were sitting in the car, and I was trying to catch up on reports. And it was 12 at night, almost 1 o'clock in the morning. And I was sitting there writing, and a lady walked up to the window, and she taps on the window, and I said, oh, shit, what's she want now? And she says, officer, she says, there's a guy down there, and he's in the store in front of the Walgreens area, he says, and he's got a rifle. And I looked at her, I says, what? So I says, okay, I said, I'll take care of it. And so I got out the car, and I said, because it was just a half a block away, I didn't want to drive up on it because anyone was driving up on it. So I said, I'll walk down and see if I can see what I'm seeing. So I took a left turn at the corner, walked down about 6 doors, and she was right. There was a guy standing there with a rifle. And we walked up on each other. He saw me the same time I saw him. And I said, hey, I said, what the hell are you doing? And he looked at me funny, and I looked at him. I said, drop the gun. And he hesitated. And I said, oh, shit, this is going to get ugly. I could see it. And he says, well, I'll drop mine if you tell him to drop his. And I said, what do you mean drop his? Because I didn't see anybody there but him. And I says, oh, man, this guy's a nut. Come to find out, there was another guy there. I had never seen this. That's when I sort of got a little shook up. I said, oh, yeah. Shit. There's a guy standing there, and I was sort of in between the two of them because I rounded the corner, and this other guy was behind me, but he didn't say anything. He was standing, and he had a gun. And it was like a Mexican standoff there between these two. And I said, hey, I said, all right, everybody take a deep breath. And I said, both of you put your guns down. And in the meantime, this woman who I had talked to me, she had sort of went on up the street, but she could sort of see what was happening, and I guess she called the department. See, in those days, patrol cars were all big Dodges, those big old Hemi Dodges, mm-hmm. and you could hear them coming across town, and I could hear these cars going, and I could hear them coming up the street, and I said, man, just let me hold on until we get some help here. And the guy that sort of saved everything was the guy that I couldn't really see because he was behind me. He says, officer, he says, I'll put mine down, and, you know, you make sure he puts his down. I said, both of you, put your guns on the ground. And by this time, people are starting to arrive now, and things get a little chaotic because of all the confusion. And they both laid their guns down. And I asked this, I said, what the hell was going on here? And the guy says, it was a bad drug deal is what it was. And one was the seller, one was the buyer. The buyer was pissed off because he didn't get what he thought he was supposed to get. And the seller had said he'd gotten all he was going to get. And I don't know how I would have ended up if I hadn't walked up on it. And it didn't really register to me how close it was until after I had everybody all hooked up and I'm standing there talking with the sergeant.
So these guys were being arrested for what, assault or drug dealing?
Drug dealing, possession of a firearm. One of them was a felon in possession of a firearm. The other guy was just crazy. And the crazy one was the one I was worried about. After everybody got hooked up and everything was okay, then it sort of sunk in. Yeah, I said, oh, man, I could have got it from both ends that day. But it didn't register with me until after it was all over with and said and done, and the real world sort of settles in on you, and you say, oh, shit, that was a close one there.
What do you think was the key thing that you did that unwound it from a possible violent situation?
Not turning something into chaos and yelling and screaming and take a deep breath, staying calm, and then you quiet it down a little bit. You tell the guys, hey, man, what's the problem? And that's when the guy took a deep breath and he says, well, I'll lay my gun down if he lays his down. And instead of me reacting, you know, start yelling at this guy behind me who I can't see, I just sort of said, yeah, okay. And I sort of looked over my shoulder real easy-like, and I said, hey, so what's going on, man? He said, well, the guy thinks I have some drugs. And
what did you take away from that? What learning might you have gotten from that experience?
If I'd have done anything stupid, it would have been ugly. It had been an ugly afternoon, you know.
So you didn't have a gun drawn. Your own gun wasn't drawn.
No, I didn't even have a chance to get mine out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later on, as things started to calm down a little bit, I eased mine out, and I had it down, you know, out of my holster, but down by my side. But they still had their two guns. And so the thing that was going through my mind, if it gets ugly, which one do you shoot it first? Because that was the first thing across my mind. You know, one's crazy and one's a felon with a gun that don't want to go back to jail. And it was a flip the coin. And now the nut was the guy that was buying. He was half high at the time, so he might have been the first one. I'd have been shooting him right off the bat.
Mm. Mary Warren is a retired psychiatric nurse. During her career, she was on the front lines dealing with some very crazy people. When one of her patients pulled a huge knife, she thought she might die.
I was working on the inpatient psych unit at Peninsula Hospital, and we had a new patient that had been admitted that morning and was admitted by another nurse on the unit, and I had not yet received report about this man. So I didn't know about him or his story. And usually we always had two people on the unit. Others had gone to lunch, and the mental health assistant that was left on the unit with me was in the restroom. And this man came up to the counter and saw me there. And he had on tall cowboy boots. And usually as part of the admission process, we make sure that we go through the luggage or whatever they have with them so that we can make sure that there's nothing untoward on the unit. But he pulled a long knife out of his cowboy boot and pointed it at me and said, I see no reason why I shouldn't use this on you right now. And you know how they say, when you're dying, things flash through your mind. Well, right. I had never had that experience until that moment. And the things that flashed through my mind were, I'm alone. I don't have time to ask for help. I'm short and slim, and I'm not going to muscle this man. And then the other thing that flashed was, I don't know him. I don't know his story. And I do know psychiatric patients can be sometimes difficult, sometimes dramatic or unruly or impulsive, and sometimes untethered to reality. So I didn't know which of those many things this man might be. The other thing that flashed through my mind and was what saved me was a very wise mentor that I had, a small woman in my training that had said to me more than once, do something unexpected and do it with kindness. And I took a deep breath and I looked at that man and I said, I'm sorry. I guess nobody explained to you that we can't have weapons on this unit. I said, I'm sorry, that's our fault. And I said, we need to keep you safe and everybody else safe. So why don't you put the knife on the counter and I'm going to put it away. And when you leave, you get it back. And he looked at me and he looked at the knife and then he put it down on the counter and he said, okay. And he turned around and walked away. And at that moment, my knees were shaking, my heart was beating, I started breathing again and realized that I had been holding my breath. And I realized how afraid I was at that moment, but that those words of my mentor came true once more. Life-saving, yeah.
What's remarkable about both Carl's and Mary's stories is their strategies to de-escalate bad situations. They always went for calm. Carl asked, "Hey, what's going on? Let's just take a deep breath." And Mary calmly explains hospital policies about weapons. Also, Mary told me later that whenever she had to deal with new admissions that might have been hysterical or dangerous, the first thing she did was offer them a cup of tea. It calmed things right down. Flying an F-4B Phantom jet at night without instruments. Fear for your life in a shootout over a drug deal gone bad or from a crazed psychiatric patient with a knife would be terrifying enough. Now, let's up the stakes even more. Imagine flying a jet fighter off an aircraft carrier in the dead of night when your cockpit lights go out. You know you're low on fuel, but can't see the gauge. That is just what happened to Winston Copeland, who started his Navy career as a fighter pilot in Vietnam. He believes his prayers to God saved his life that night.
Now, have you asked me, Winston, have you ever been afraid? Of course I've been afraid. Any fighter pilot will tell you he's not been afraid. He's lying to you. Well, I'll give you a very good example. In November 1969, I'm writing a chapter on this. It was a dark, dark night in November in the Gulf of Tonkin. I was flying as a wingman. I was a very junior pilot. I'd only been in the squadron maybe 6 months, only been at sea for a couple of months. And I had a spark in my cockpit go from the right side of the airplane to the left side in the cockpit. Shut down every light in the airplane. I went, what the heck is that all about? So I called my skipper on the radio, and because he was in the other airplane, and I said, hey, I got a problem here. I lost all the lights in my cockpit. He said, oh, no problem. Here's what you do. Mad Dog, just turn the generators off one at a time, cycle them, and the lights will come back for you. Okay, sir. So I did. Lights did not come back. He said, well, hey, not to worry. Here's what we'll do. I'll put you on my wing, and I'll bring you down to the carrier, and when we get to half a mile, I'll peel off to the left, you land, like we've practiced a time or two. I said, okay, sir, I got that. So sure enough, he puts me on his right wing, and we come down, and I mean, my heart beats racing here pretty good, and I come in, and I did not realize that we were on the glide slope coming down, all coming down, coming down. So when he peeled off the left, I pulled power. I reduced power. Silly of me to do that because I'm already coming down. He had me set up perfectly. I screwed it up horribly. I pulled the power. The airplane descended below the glide slope. The landing signal officer is screaming at me to add power. My backseater is screaming at me to add power. I added power for everybody. I went way above the glide slope. So they waved me off. And sure enough, true to form, the skipper was there 400 feet off to my left. I joined on him. He brought me around again. I still had no lights. And I did not know how much fuel I had. So he brings me around to the carrier, set it up again perfectly. I mean, perfectly. On lineup, on airspeed, on the glide. So I couldn't have been set up more perfectly. This guy was a very gifted aviator, very gifted. So I said, now, Winston, don't screw this up. You got the whole ship watching you. Don't embarrass yourself. Okay. So I come down. Everything's cool. I cross the ramp, the back end of the ship. And I squeaked on a little power, and either I skipped the number four wire or my hook bounced over it. I don't know, but I wasn't stopping. Add a full power back up again. And this time the skipper says to himself, we're out of here. We're going to go to Da Nang, 100 miles away, and land because Copeland is not going to get on the ship tonight. Okay, so we added power, raised the gear, raised the flaps, up we go. I don't know, we went to 38,000 feet or something. And Rick, I'm scared. I am scared because I'm running out of fuel. I don't know what I've got. And we're going to come down through the clouds. I'm on his wing, and I'm deathly afraid I'm going to lose him. And if I do, then there's only one way out, and I've got to eject. So
this is nighttime. So you are
nighttime. It's dark in the inside of a cat.
Yep.
and I'm really, really close to his wingtip. I mean, really close. Anyway, I said a prayer to myself. I said, Lord, get me down. I promise I will go to church every single Sunday this deployment. Promise, promise. Not a Girl Scout's honor. I promise. Well, we broke out about 400 feet above the ground, Da Nang, two long runways, lights all lit up to beat the band. The skipper lands on the left and I land on the right. Halfway down the runway that I'm on, my right engine quits. Fuel starvation.
Out of gas.
Out of gas. Now that was close.
Had you been still flying when that happened, you would have...
I'd have been in deep trouble.
Maybe your prayers were answered.
I think so. I think so. And let me tell you, Rick, make no mistake. I went to church every single Sunday after that. You don't make contracts with God and don't come through.
Well, that's a good strategy, especially if you want help again.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, my God. That night flying without lights, boy, that would be something.
Not good. Not good.
Iron workers. Through photography, I got to meet some iron workers putting up a building in downtown Redwood City. Every few days, I'd show up on the street corner with my camera and my tripod. Finally, I even got to interview some of these thrill-seeking risk-takers. One guy came up to me and engaged me in conversation on the street. I asked him, what was the best part of being an iron worker? Watching the building go up, he said. What is the worst part? The funerals, he said without missing a beat. Daily fear and the ever-present possibility of injury or death is what they live with each day. According to Supervisor Larry Lippert, who we met in Chapter 2, iron workers do the most dangerous job there is. Tragedy can happen in the blink of an eye.
What we do is probably as dangerous as you can get. As fast as you can flick a light switch is how fast something can go bad. Crane collapses, I've seen that. Seen a lot of bad shit over the years. Two bad accidents on the ground in the boneyard. You know, I had a piece of iron hit, knocked a 5,000 pound dog bone header over on another iron worker that we had to pick up off him that blew a hole the size of a softball in his leg, ended his career. I had one just a couple years ago right after lunch. They set a choker on a hook, and he wasn't paying attention. And as the load line came up, there was another hook that caught top flange and pulled a beam right over on him. You know, so yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff, I can still hear that screaming in my head, you know.
Jose Hernandez. Jose lives for the thrill of the adrenaline rush he gets working high up, and the higher the better, all the while walking around on a 4-inch beam.
We know the dangers of the job and everything, but it's fantastic for us because we're thrill seekers. We love adrenaline. You know, there's a lot of things that give you adrenaline, but to actually get paid for it, it's fantastic. Some days you don't really want the adrenaline and it comes really heavy. And some days there's no adrenaline at all. So it all depends on what you're doing. Your height, I say the higher you go up, the better. You'll slow it down, and the fear is always there. When you don't have adrenaline, it's because you're really comfortable around your surroundings, and it's not there. So for me, that's why we have to go up, for the adrenaline.
Are you saying that the higher up you are, the more adrenaline?
Yes, because not only that, the fall, it gets into your head a lot more. And just the whole situation involving the higher you go up, the danger, the things that could go wrong, everything just multiplies. So that's why I feel that it's more exciting when it's bigger pieces, bigger steel, higher up. So that's my interpretation of adrenaline. I think I work better under adrenaline because it makes me think more. It makes me think of no lost moves. So you want to be at attention at all times when you're up that high. And that's why I love it, I think. I've never had to focus on a job like the job I do now. A time where it went really bad, just seeing people fall. When people fall and they're close to you, it almost seems like you can almost reach out and grab them because it just slows down time. But truth of the matter is that you can't stop them. And it stays in the back of your head at all times. I mean, they're looking right at you and they're falling. So all you got is the memory. And sometimes that's kind of hard to grasp.
Unlike Jose, I don't love the rush of adrenaline. It's happened a few times in my life. Never something I want to repeat. The siren was screaming and the red lights flashing as the police car came roaring up behind me. I quickly pulled over. Then I saw both doors fly open and two cops come running toward me. I kept my hands on the wheel. A moment later, the passenger door was flung open and I was looking down the barrel of a gunmetal steel-gray Smith & Wesson 38 Special Police revolver. The cop yelled, "Freeze!" I didn't move a muscle. He took a second look, lowered his gun. Then he shouted at the other cop, "Never mind, Bob. Wrong guy." Looking back at me, "Sorry, buddy. You look like a murderer that we're after." As I started to breathe again, I was surprised that my pants weren't wet. It was an otherwise pleasant afternoon as I was negotiating a left turn off of University Avenue onto Sacramento Street in Berkeley. It's a day I will never forget. Porterville State Hospital. I was thrilled that I got the summer internship between my junior and senior year at the Porterville State Hospital for the Severely Retarded, now called Porterville Developmental Center in Porterville, California. I was thrilled, but also terrified. This facility housed patients that were too disabled and too handicapped to live in their residential communities. Their families couldn't care for them. I'd read about the insane asylums and madhouses of the 18th century, with crazy screaming people literally chained to the walls in prison-like facilities. Was this what I was in for? As my car pulled off the main highway onto the hospital grounds, my heart was pounding like a bass drum in a high school marching band. Getting settled in our student dorms, we could see patients on the grounds in wheelchairs, walking with attendants, shuffling aimlessly around. Once we got into our daily routine, assisting psychologists with testing and patient care, I got more relaxed and less fearful. However, working on the back wards always cranked up my anxiety level. We worked with patients who were so disabled they couldn't even get out of bed and were not toilet trained. Some had IQs in the 20s. Almost all had congenital defects that had no cure. They simply were warehoused. They had to be fed and bathed by us and by the attendants. Most would die in Porterville. About a week into this new internship, my fears subsided. The summer was a valuable learning experience I will never forget. Like a lot of things in life, to get the benefit, I had to face down my own fear. Mental retardation is one thing. Severe mental illness is another. The paranoid delusional Green Beret. For a while during my career as a psychologist, I worked on a locked psychiatric ward, facing down a raging paranoid schizophrenic 250-pound ex-Green Beret. One day, I thought this might be my last day on planet Earth.
It was a warm summer day in Marin County. I was working on the crisis unit at Marin General Hospital. I was a mental health worker. About 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm at the intake desk, drinking my coffee, things are going easy. Suddenly, phone rings. Crisis unit. "Yeah, this is SF General. We have a psych patient for you." "Okay, what's the deal?" "Well, his name is Bob. He's a Vietnam vet. He was in special forces. He weighs 260 pounds, and he's paranoid and delusional." "Okay, send him over." Shit, there goes the morning. About an hour later, Gurney comes in, and here's Bob. He's got leather restraints holding him down. His clothes are wet and wrinkled. He smells like cigarettes and urine. He looks okay. We begin doing the intake process, and we take off the leather restraints, and he slowly gets up. Look out! Incoming! Gooks everywhere! And he runs down the hall, around the corner, out of view. We all take off after him. The psychiatrist, the nurses, the admitting clerk, me. I go running down the hall, and here's Bob. He's in this room, only one entrance to the room, and I walk in, and I'm between Bob and the door. Now, I'm a psychologist. I'm a mental health worker in a crisis unit. Surely, I know what to say to fix this situation. Bob, take it easy. You're going to be okay. Nobody is going to hurt you here. Whatever the right words were, those weren't the ones. What happened next is Bob rears up in some sort of karate thing. Boom! Right on my... I go, whoa! I'm a pile against the wall. I see Bob going out the door down the hall. I hear glass crashing, more people screaming. Oh, Jesus. Am I okay? God, my left arm hurts like hell. Well, at least I'm wounded in battle. Nobody's going to expect me to chase that son of a bitch down the hall. As it turned out, my arm was broken. I go to X-ray, I get a cast.
In my psych class the following Monday, I had a great story to tell about losing a fight with a Green Beret. I always felt that if there was a badge of honor in the mental health field like a Purple Heart, I should have gotten it. Oh my God, they're all dead. The Lodi drag races were over at 3:30 p.m. on that overcast Sunday afternoon in March of 1957. Fred and Jeff had both raced their hot 1950 Oldsmobiles. There were 10 of us between these two street rods. As if by second nature, when we pulled out of the muddy, rain-soaked parking lot, we immediately started racing. Within a mile, though, Fred's car was way ahead of us. After all, he had a three-quarter race Escandarian camshaft and two four-barrel carbs. We didn't have a chance. Winding around the back roads outside of Stockton, we laughed as we recalled the various screw-ups of the day. Flat tire, busted fan belt. Our jovial mood, though, was shattered as we crested a hill to see Fred's car up against a telephone pole. The hood was up, the trunk and the doors were open, bodies were strewn all over the road. Terrified, we skidded to a stop. Both doors flew open. The five of us rushed over to the wreck, hoping to help our injured or dying friends. But I noticed there was no blood and no writhing in pain. As we got closer, our friends leaped to their feet and started laughing hysterically. We'd been had. I remember it like it was yesterday. Some of us seek out fear and adrenaline or have it built into our jobs like the ironworkers. Others, like Mary Warren and Carl Johnson, get it thrust at them as part of their work. Fear is beneficial. It alerts us to danger. It produces a flood of chemicals, including adrenaline and serotonin, which help us respond better in an emergency. That adrenaline rush can also be a high. After I got my ass kicked by that Green Beret, I felt great. I'd survived. Imagine that. Wouldn't want to do it every day, but the rush did feel good. To give you relief from all of this adrenaline, in the next chapter, we're going to relax a bit with some humor, including what Bob Hope said when my daughter turned him down for a kiss.